from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by conservative political commentator Dan Proft, liberal Mark Casello, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Our program tonight coming to you from our new home at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Happy Father's Day to you all. Nice to have you with us. Tonight we're going to be talking about presidential politics again, against some of the issues, some of the things we've been talking about for the last several weeks on this program. But again, things shift each and every week, obviously, since we see you. And you know, one of the big stories is the great rousing reception that Texas Governor Rick Perry got last night at a Republican event in the South. And my question to you, Charles Lipson, is there a room for Rick Perry? And if he were to jump into this race, who would most likely be hurt the most?
There is definitely room for him. And the key point is that he would be a very credible opponent to the front runner right now, Mitt Romney. So anybody else who's trying to edge into that position, whether it's Michelle Bachmann or Tim Pawlenty, would be hurt. He would suck up a lot of oxygen. I'm assuming that Sarah Palin's not running.
Dan Proft is our Republican tonight. Your take on Rick Perry. Last week, or when you were on this program, you said that Tim Pawlenty is sort of your guy at this moment. Is that a long-term commitment, or
I'm actually kind of
to be moved.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of restraining myself and withholding judgment. I want to see this play out a little bit more. I thought Pawlenty kind of shrunk in his moment of opportunity.
Absolutely.
At the debate on Monday in New Hampshire. So I think there's still a lot of people auditioning for that role as the anti-Romney candidate. And Rick Perry has a very easy and very compelling story to tell, which is in the last 10 years as governor of Texas, Texas is a state that's created 40% of all new jobs in this country. So if this is going to be an election about jobs and creating an economic climate that incentivizes entrepreneurship and produces wealth creation and business location, then he has a story to tell that nobody else in the field has.
Mark Casello, a question to you. You are a liberal tonight. You're a college professor at Ivy Tech and also write for the Huffington Post, so you're left of center. Do you think there is enough independents? I won't even say Democrats, because I don't think Democrats would give him the time of day. But do you think there's enough independents out there that could get over Rick Perry's accent and the fact that he's a Texas governor to give him at least a look and a possible vote?
I think Rick Perry's a very credible candidate. He's a perfect foil for Obama in the race, actually. He's a family man. He has a perfect family like the Obamas. As well, his wife is very active in promoting health care causes and education, much like Michelle Obama. So he's going to be a good foil for that. And I think his attitude, he's got, as Dan mentioned, his work on the economy in Texas will be marketable to the independents. And I think Barack Obama, I know the rhetoric of the right during the debates was about failure and declinist. And I think Rick Perry promotes an optimistic message. And I think that could carry some of the independents.
And don't forget, he's a Democrat who became a Republican.
Right. He's got the
conversion story. He's got that story to tell. And, you know, and there's other issues, too, that are more populist in nature, not so partisan, like immigration, where, of course, being a border state, he's been at the forefront of discussing as well. And the last thing I would say to him is he's not wealthy, right? He's not personally wealthy, so he's not bringing a $500 million fortune to the table like Romney or even a John Huntsman. And while that's – I don't think it's a huge issue, I think the idea that this is not somebody who is so detached from the ordinary concerns of middle-class Americans is probably something that he could speak
but
to.
But the question I want to come back to everybody, yep, because you're a man from the South. You got rid of, you know, you don't have the accent. You got a little bit of accent left.
What you talking about, man?
You're from Marks, Mississippi. But my question is, there's a lot of elitists out there. There's a lot of snooty people out there. A lot of them vote in a Republican primary and Democratic primaries. And they will hear his Texas accent and they will be turned off by that. They will not. They will not be able. I'm talking about a lot of maybe people that you'd never get anywhere.
That's right.
But is that? I mean, it also speaks to the issue, at least what the alleged pros have said, that the Republicans wouldn't want another governor from Texas because of the Bush stain that they view.
First of all, I don't think there are the Republicans. There's no big party apparat that's going to choose this. But I do think that you're right in saying that coming from the South is a disadvantage, and coming from Texas is a special disadvantage. Lyndon Johnson, two Bushes, and now another candidate. But that's not his main disadvantage, in my opinion. His strength is that he's is what Dan has outlined, and he's got a lot of zip, but his he really has presence. But his weakness is going to be that he's put out very strong positions on social issues that will be hard to sell to moderate independents, even though they will be red meat, I think, to many in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I disagree. I think it's a point of emphasis. I don't think you need to – I don't think it's a problem for somebody to be a social conservative and be the Republican nominee. I think it's a point of emphasis. And the emphasis that Rick Perry has made the hallmark of, for certainly his last term, has been jobs, and it has been basically states' rights, the kind of discussing the power relationship between the federal government and the states. And the other thing, too, just in terms of him being, you know, oh, it's another governor from Texas. Here's somebody when he gets hit with the, oh, this is Bush's third term. He's the guy who took on the Bush Republicans.
That's right.
He beat Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who is backed by the establishment Republicans right. and the Bushes in Texas, and won. So I think that's another feather in his cap.
Mark.
But to add to that as well, you've got to remember Rick Perry is the longest serving governor in the country right now, current 10 years. So he's weathered 9/11. He's weathered the recession. So he's got a great record to run on. And I think he's actually a dual threat for both the primary and the general election. He's going to have trouble walking back some of those social issues, but he's got that Tea Party vote locked in. But I think his governing record
right.
is legitimate enough.
He
to
will
make
be
him a
very formidable in a general. I completely yeah. agree with both oh, yeah. of you. I'm not trying to
why play
him down.
Why would he not run? Why would he not do it then?
Oh, I think he will.
I think he's going to get in. I think he probably didn't see an opportunity before, maybe for some of the reasons that Charles outlined. But I think as this election has worn on and the lack of anybody to rise up against Romney and be the clear alternative to Romney, I think he sees an opportunity that is actually there.
The president looks vulnerable of the economy.
You talked about right. The debate the other night. I want to get everybody's reaction to that who saw it, because, again, my impression, again, it's not that different than some things that most people have probably heard already. I think that Tim Pawlenty really hurt himself. I mean, he came across like an absolute wimp. When pressed to basically take on Romney right there when he was within striking distance of him. And the other person that I would say, and I've been very critical of her, I was very impressed with Michelle Bachmann. I thought that she outperformed any expectation that I had for her. Mark?
Oh, absolutely. But for me, the big surprise in the debate on last Monday was that compared to the 2008 debates, the candidates as a field are softer in tone and rhetoric than they were. You didn't have a Giuliani up there attacking Ron Paul. And just as a field, there was no discussion of, before in 2008, it was like, who could waterboard the most? Who is in favor of enhanced interrogation techniques?
That's a good point. We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8029. If you saw the debate, let's get your assessment. 1-800-723-8029. From Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. From the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to go to calls in just a moment. But, Mark, you wanted to make another comment about the debate last week.
Sure. Well, part of the softening of the tone I noticed during the debate, there was many references to how many children everyone had. Michelle Bachmann repeatedly referred to her 23 foster children, but something felt different to me. It wasn't simply a reference to family in a traditional conservative sense. And so I speculated in the piece I wrote for the Huffington Post last week that somehow the maternal nature of these candidates or their fecundity, their fertility, could actually translate into sort of an economic message, that the fact that Mitt Romney is parenting 10 children suggests that somehow he can grow jobs or grow the economy the way you would grow children almost.
That's interesting.
What do you think about that?
I mean, I think like Mitt Romney and Michelle Bachmann look like they belong on top of a wedding cake. So I agree with you on that part of it. But I actually think that that play, and you're right, and the repeated references, especially Bachman, but I think it's more kind of a subliminal way to say they have intergenerational perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That they understand that there's real concern that parents have about leaving a country that is going to provide less opportunity for their children or their grandchildren than they enjoyed. And I think that's kind of what that speaks to.
But I think the big flaw, strategical flaw of that, is that they ignored any reference to the elderly in America. And so it positioned them as being about the young people, but where are the old people, you know, and they don't want to bring that up because of Ryan's Social Security.
I thought the problem
plan
that they were caught with in the debate was they were trying the Republicans can sense that Obama's vulnerable and they want to win the general election, and they're not quite sure, the candidates, whether they're trying to position themselves in the general election or win the primary. And I thought that the flinching that Tim Pawlenty did, which really hurt him badly, was really trying to keep the focus on Obama. I didn't think it was just fear about facing down Romney, although it might have been.
First of all, you've got to win the primary.
Of course you do.
The guy that's ahead of you, that's the guy you got to chop his
legs exactly
off.
Right. But they may also fear that direct attacks on the other Republicans in a year when Republicans sense they might be able to win at all would actually hurt them even in the primary. But I think, I'm completely agreeing with you.
I think there's a concern about being the guy that throws the first punch. I think that was probably Pawlenty's concern, especially after he said, "I'm not going to raise the Obamacare moniker that I came up with."
Yeah.
And I think he was kind of caught betwixt and between a little bit. But, you know, the good news for some of these candidates is with Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul in the race, you almost always are going to look more positive. So there's a lot of room to navigate and still go after the front
Ron
runner
Paul
and not look angry.
Ron Paul really showed his age, I thought. Compared to Ron Paul 4 years ago, I thought his age really showed.
I think he's still talking about the Federal Reserve.
Well, he is, but again,
I mean, he's still on stage talking about the Federal Reserve.
He seems a little more doddering than he did four years ago.
He did, and what you could see was how much time Michelle Bachman has spent doing television interviews, because she was sharp and crisp in 30-second intervals.
Well, the first time, right. I mean, one of the things I noticed is that the question was coming from a guest who was in another part of the state and was projected on a large screen. But when they shot Michelle Bachman on camera, she was like looking up, you know, and it looked odd. So it went back to her horrible State of the Union speech when she was looking at the wrong camera. I said, oh, my gosh, she hasn't learned anything. She's doing it. But then when they took the long shot, I realized that she was looking at the big monitor. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana. WoWo is the station. Fred's listening to us tonight. Nice to hear from Indiana tonight. Go ahead, Fred.
I think Herman Cain, after the debate, had a good point.
I thought he did well as well.
Well, after the debate, he said that the format could have been better in that each candidate got an individual question instead of throwing up one topic for everybody to comment on. And then, in fact, they were supposed to have had 40 seconds apiece to answer it. It came down to more like something like 25, 30 seconds apiece. How you can even say anything in 30 seconds and have steel nerves at the same time and get your point across kind of beats me.
I think I don't like those medicinal debates.
Who's asking you?
I think that it's – I'm giving you my opinion, sir. You just gave yours.
You don't decide the formats.
Sir, listen.
I'm listening.
If you know in advance – and you agree, and everybody agrees in advance that it's going to be 30 seconds here and 30 seconds there, the candidates really have the ability to sort of, you know, practice that, and they come up with a canned answer.
One of the
things I liked about this was the spontaneity of it, that people have to sort of think on their feet, and it isn't restricted. And some people, I thought, use their time well. I think most of the candidates use that. Yes, you may.
Okay. If they put out one topic for all of them to address, then if there was differences between them, it could be more broadly brought out.
I agree with that.
absolutely.
Well, then what are you complaining about?
Well, I'm not complaining about anything, sir. You were complaining about my having an opinion on my show. But thanks very much for calling. That's why I'm here.
You should call into his show. You should call into his show, Bruce.
Call into his show. Yeah. That's all right.
That's it.
That's good. Good to hear from Indiana. Let's go to Schaumburg, Illinois. WLS is the place. Joe's the caller.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Hi, panel. As far as the debate goes last week, I agree with you, Bruce, that Tim Pawlenty absolutely basically chickened out. But then again, he realized he made the mistake, and he said it, I think, yesterday or a couple of days ago, that he's going after Romney again. I mean, for these people to start getting any traction, I think there's other debates coming up. I think they're going to start going after him. I think Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann both did it this week. But for them to get any traction at all, and believe me, there's a lot to go after that guy.
The point is, if you're going to go after,
he chickened out.
If you're going to go after a candidate when you're appearing on a news show,
right,
and then you end up and you're 3 feet away from them and you can't look them in the eye and take them
right
on, I frankly don't know how you think you're going to be the leader of the free world.
Right, but like I was saying, there's a lot to go after Mitt Romney. Let's not forget that when he was governor of Massachusetts during his tenure.
Well, let somebody do it. I'm just saying is that nobody did it the other night. By the way, I also thought Rick Santorum did a pretty good job.
I think they're going to start, though. Eventually, they're going to start.
I think it was just
a warm-up Monday night, but I think they're going to start. I really do.
They're going to have to, especially those that want to, again, position themselves as the anti-Romney candidate. Frankly, I thought Romney, and I'm not a big fan of Romney's for some of the reasons the caller was alluding to, but I thought you saw the experience of having run before. I thought Romney was much less mechanical.
Yep.
He was probably the most conversational of all the candidates.
Yep.
I thought his answers were pretty good, even if some of them were a little bit creative relative to the facts. I thought he came off well. And let me tell you something else about Romney. When the financial reporting comes the end of this month, the quarterly numbers, I think you're going to see Mitt Romney has lapped the field in terms of fundraising, and that is going to strengthen the view of him as the front runner.
He brought up the subject, and again, it was mentioned by virtually every other candidate. He brought up the wisdom of our many wars, and whether or not it's time for he called them the Afghanis, as opposed to the Afghans, to sort of fight their own civil war. But I mean, does that represent a position that would have any traction and popularity with independents again, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's what Romney and some of these other candidates that are being labeled isolationist are sensing, because you don't have that distinction. Obama's pushed us further into these wars, into Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq. And so I think, the Republican candidate sense that you could peel off some of those independents if they give a softer tone. And I think that also is a distinction from 2008 we're seeing.
It's certainly a distinction from 2008, because McCain blasted all of them for sounding isolationist.
Right.
Dwight Eisenhower ran in 52 against the Democrat with a vague promise he was going to go to Korea. Richard Nixon ran with a unfathomable vague promise he was going to bring us home with honor and so forth.
Going to end the war.
Going to end the war with honor, withdraw with honor. These were as vacuous as hope and change. And so the idea is to throw out something that will appeal to independents with as little definition as your opponent will let you get away with.
Yeah. And also, by doing so, give the impression, rightly so, that you're zero focused on domestic issues in the economy.
Right.
But then you see sitting Republicans like Lindsey Graham today attacking these candidates, which I think is a bad move
It's a bad move for Lindsey Graham, but
Lindsey Graham and John McCain, they're the frickin' frack of the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
I mean, the point is, John McCain represents yesterday. And it seems to me when you're talking about the Sunday morning shows, whether there's bias on the Sunday morning shows. You know when there's bias on the Sunday morning shows?
Selection.
When someone says, we have an exclusive interview with John McCain. That's not a big deal. Because, John, when you keep presenting as the voice of the Republican Party a has-been politician who served his country well, but you know what? His time has passed. He didn't get the message the last time the voters voted. And yet those people who booked those Sunday shows, and who's the other guy that's always available? It's his buddy. Mm-hmm. So they end up making the comments, but neither one of them has a future in the Republican Party, I don't believe.
Well, neither one of them can kind of hold fast to a position for more than 5 minutes. So that's part of their problem, too, which is why the media loves them.
But I think it's also the case that the Republicans have in the back of their mind Sharon Angle and some of the other people who they had a vulnerable candidate in Harry Reid in Nevada, and they didn't put up the strongest candidate, I think a lot of Republicans feel. And I think that that was in the back of a lot of minds during the Republican debate.
Well, they have, but the point is the Republican primary voters have a track record of making some pretty bad selections. I'm talking about the primary voters.
Right.
They make some real bad selections. You would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole next in line.
We're laughing because.
Got a pause. Yes. Next shortly. Yes. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Mark Casella was here. He is a contributor to Huffington Post. He's also an associate professor of English, radical English, at Ivy Tech Community College in Bloomington, Indiana. Dan Proft joins us. He is a political commentator for WLS Radio, ran in the Republican primary for governor of the state of Illinois, and has emerged as a leading conservative commentator in the Midwest. And also joining us this evening is Charles Utzon from the University of Chicago. And this past week, he won the Quantrell Award for Outstanding Undergraduate Teaching. And how does one win that award? Was it the swimsuit competition?
There was a lot of walking around money involved. The students do it, and it's a process that is opaque. I don't know what happened, but it was it's the oldest undergraduate teaching award in the country, or maybe the oldest teaching award, and I felt just terrific about winning it.
How many years teaching at the University of Chicago for
been
you?
Been teaching there since the late 70s.
Late 70s.
I'll have to get out of calculator.
Figure it out. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Bryant, listening to us on KQMS in Redding, California. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon, or is it evening back there now?
Well, it's evening back here, but it's a bright, sunny afternoon in California, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it's about 100 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's starting to get hotter. We're now hitting our dry weather now.
Yeah, and you're in Northern California.
Northern California, we're the largest city north of Sacramento. In fact, Northern California think that anything north of Sacramento is north. Everything south is south of California.
Mm-hmm. Good.
What's your question? The reason I called was you guys made a comment on the break before the last one, or just early, about Michelle Bachmann's 23 children, and I think you said Mitt Romney's 10, and you were discussing the issue of fecundity or something along that line. And I'm going, what has that got to do with the candidate? He did it with Sarah Palin and her children and so on. Let's stay away from the children, period.
I can respond to that. Yeah. I didn't bring up the children. The candidates did. And I'm just questioning the use of candidates as part of the political process. Family's always been included in political campaigns, but I'm suggesting that there's something different. I think it's great that Michelle Bachmann has many foster children. She's a pro-life candidate. By adopting those children, she shows she's walking the talk, and I think that's great. But my question was, how is it being used politically by the candidates? And I'm not bringing it up. I'm just responding to something that's out there.
But also, too, I mean, at the beginning, at the outset,
that's right.
What's his name? The moderator, King, asked all of them to give like a little bio. And so if you have a wife and children, you're going to mention that, or a husband and children, in the case of Bachmann, you're going to mention that in your bio. I think Bachmann referenced it a couple more times to your point, Mark, that mm-hmm. she was kind of brandishing that she's somebody who's walked the walk.
And I think that it's the early part of the campaign. So a lot of what you're trying to do is get a picture of yourself out there that's friendly and that can sort of connect with voters.
Did Michelle Bachmann, in your view, did she help herself significantly? And would you consider her a serious candidate for the nomination now, Charles?
She helped herself. She's a serious candidate. She won't get the nomination because I think, first of all, it's very difficult to run for the presidency from the House, and especially if you haven't had a lot of administrative experience. And the second thing is that I think her social positions are really her strength, and this is going to be an economic. I mean, she is a favorite of the Tea Parties, it's true, but she has very strong social positions that would be up front in any campaign.
But as more and more people, at least what I've read, gave her very high marks in that debate, does that send a very strong signal to Sarah Palin that maybe there's no room for Sarah Palin, Dan?
Well, and maybe there's really no interest by Sarah Palin in running either. Sarah Palin also said this week she thought Michelle Bachmann was qualified to be president, which was kind of a stamp of
approval.
Well, and approval may be a stretch, but certainly saying that this is somebody who's legitimate in my eyes.
But I think that if Rick Perry gets in the race, the big loser will be all the other candidates, but especially Bachmann, maybe a Herman Cain, who also did well.
I'll tell you what, but the difference between Bachmann and Cain both have some Tea Party appeal, and the good thing for Romney is that if Perry does get in, now you've got several candidates that have strong Tea Party appeal that could be carving up that sizable percentage of the primary electorate. But the difference between Bachmann and Cain is Bachmann can raise money. I mean, as a congressman, she has raised a ton of money, and if she performs well in Iowa, or maybe even wins Iowa, let's say Rick Perry doesn't get in, she has every opportunity, I think, to win Iowa. That becomes very, very interesting going into New Hampshire and then going south.
I think a lot of them are thinking that Romney could be in the position of Hillary Clinton. That is, everybody presumes is the front runner, and as soon as there's a crack in that position, that sort of everybody believes this, then he would fall quickly.
Well, also, I mean,
that's what I think they think.
If he has written off, and he has, if Romney has written off Iowa, again, Michelle Bachmann does well there. Romney should certainly do well. The expectations, he can only lose if he doesn't
win big in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Then again, for the umpteenth time, it comes back to who wins South Carolina. And I would say maybe Michelle Bachmann at that particular time. Certainly if Rick Perry is in, he's probably got a leg up in South Carolina.
I think one of the other things that Perry's going to have a big advantage on, too, is being a governor for 10 years. And the same thing with Pawlenty and Huntsman, and to some extent Romney, too. Being an executive of a state for a long period of time with a record to point to, I think, is going to be more important in this election cycle than maybe others because of the fact we have a novice in the White House, and that hasn't worked out very well. So people are going to, I think, put a little bit extra emphasis on some executive experience.
Was Newt Gingrich the picture that didn't develop in that debate?
He was utterly forgettable. Was Newt there? I didn't.
He was very professorial. The
mudslinging begins.
But he seemed bothered to be there.
He should.
He seemed disdainful to have to answer these questions.
He should have re-upped on the Mediterranean vacation.
Yeah, he's probably
should have taken the second week.
He should have opted to stay
on the cruise.
He seemed irrelevant. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Jean's listening to us on KLBJ. She has a question about Rick Perry or a comment.
Hi, guys. It's more a comment. I just wanted to tell y'all that, well, Rick Perry signed the sonogram bill here in Texas for women that, you know, they're going to have to watch a sonogram before they can get an abortion. I think that he's going to have a lot of women that are not going to vote for him. It was very upsetting. I think all over the United States, it seemed like there was attack on women's, you know, rights. And also, he didn't touch immigration. He's not touched immigration. We have all this violence on our border. And I know, you know, I hear some of the guests talking really highly about him and, you know, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, I'm one of those people that, you know, has suffered, that has been on food stamps for the first time in my life, that was getting unemployment checks because of lowered hours at work. I'm getting better. Hopefully now we're on the road to recovery, me and my family, but it's not all been, you know, like it's been talked about in the media about Texas, and I live in Austin. And another thing is that why doesn't the main media ever talk about that Rick Perry attended Bilderberg years ago? And I want to know, as a citizen, what is this elite group, and who are they, and why do they meet in private, and what do they talk about?
Mark?
Well, I wanted to touch on the point the caller brought up, which I thought was an excellent one, is about Rick Perry's interference or meddling into female health issues. Another issue that may become a burden for him during the campaign was his requirement that all women receive the HPV vaccination for the human papillomavirus. to prevent cervical cancer, which seems to be counter to many Republican positions about health care decisions should be made by the individual.
What if he I don't know what his position on this is, but what if he says these are state issues and this was passed in Texas by the legislature? This was not fiat by the governor. If Massachusetts wants to do it differently, that's the nature of our government.
Yeah, I don't think Federalist arguments work very well, and I think Romney is running into that reality right now, trying to distinguish what he did in Massachusetts versus what he'd do as president. But again, I don't think Rick Perry has to run away from being a social conservative. I think you embrace it. You say, I believe in the sanctity of human life, and I want to advance policies consistent with that, but that is not going to be the focus rhetorically or substantively of his campaign.
Charles, you were saying before we went on the air, you think that maybe the campaign is going to move away from economic issues? Did I hear you right?
No. I was saying that I thought that in comments over the last 2 weeks that Charles Krauthammer has made consistently, I think that he's picked up on something very important. The 2010 election was about economics, and the Republicans won, but it was about the federal deficit. It was about entitlements. It was about centralization in Washington. The 2012 campaign looks more and more like it'll be about a different element of economics, the overall performance of the country economically. If it is about that, then it's about stewardship. And I think both Perry and Romney are in very strong positions if that's the nature of the campaign, that Republican primary voters will look at them and say, look, both have a very strong record on economic growth, on their capability. They will make capable stewards.
Who would be encouraging at this point Rick Perry to get in? Where would the money be coming from? You say Rick Perry's not a wealthy man. Where would the money be coming from to get him into this race, Dan?
Yeah, I'm not precisely sure because, since Mitch Daniels decided he wasn't going to run, one of his top guys, Al Hubbard, has gone to the Pawlenty camp. I'm not sure if Wall Street, which was going to be strongly behind Mitch Daniels, may take a look at Rick Perry, especially with what he's done with Texas's economy relative to the nation over the last 10 years, and go that direction. And certainly there's a lot of wealthy people that have helped Rick Perry get elected 3 times in Texas, so that's the base of his support for starters.
Very good. 1-800-723-8029. Back with calls when we continue from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. For those watching the program on television this evening, it is a television show in Chicago. You've been seeing some of the video clips from the big party we threw on Thursday night, in which we offered the sneak preview open house of the new Museum of Broadcast Communications. And all of our guests this evening were there, night to enjoy it. A crowd of over 550 people in attendance, a bipartisan crowd. A little drinking, a little celebrating, a little great hors d'oeuvres. Charles, you were working the hors d'oeuvres pretty well.
I didn't
leave
any for the other guests, but there was.
At least you didn't pull up a chair. That was very good.
there were so many great faces there. There were
Bozo was there.
Bozo was there, and it was striking, Bruce.
Van
how many politicians did not want to be photographed with Bozo?
Yeah, I wonder why. I wonder why.
I think that they all remembered that Dukakis view of climbing out of that tank.
Yeah, they didn't want to play the grand prize game either.
No.
Exactly. But again, it was a wonderful turnout. Again, all the people that were there that made it a very special night. And again, special thanks also Senator John Cullerton, the president of the Illinois Senate, was there. For those listening around the country, one of the major players in Illinois politics, as well as the governor of the state of Illinois, Pat Quinn, and he of course has been a longtime supporter of the project and provided some of the major funding that allowed us to complete the Corn Shell building. In fact, this is what the governor had to say, or part of what he had to say, Thursday night.
Harvey, I had the honor of meeting them in life, and they're really giants in making sure that people learned about all kinds of things that they didn't know about through the medium of radio. And that's true of others in TV. Some of the pioneers of television were right here in Chicago, Illinois, center of the country. And we want to encourage people to come to our place in this museum when it's completed and we'll get on that mission as fast as possible. It will be a very special place for people to gather and learn. And as Bruce said, this is going to be gold with respect to the whole area of energy efficiency. It's LEED gold. That means that we believe in energy efficiency and renewable energy and water conservation. That's something all of us have to take as our ethic every day. And I really look forward to working with Mayor Emanuel, who's with us, and he's going to be speaking in a minute, on that mission for every building that we build in Illinois, or any building that we're remodeling. We have to make sure that we follow those fundamental principles of a green way of thinking and a green way of acting.
That's good. At a fundraiser, he's talking about a green way of getting things done.
Also, and you announced some green there, too. There were some very important donations.
We were very pleased to announce $500,000 in new donations to the museum. Again, so we appreciate that support. And the mayor, the governor alluded to the mayor who was there, and I hear a couple of things that he had to say.
So it's an honor to be here. I want to say something also what the governor spoke about in the sense of the LEED certified building here, putting the resources towards that. Here in Chicago, we have more LEED certified buildings, energy efficient buildings, than any other major city in the world. And at my first public building commission meeting, we set the goal to take it from 43 to double it in my term. So we will maintain that LEED because you cannot sit on a LEED, you have to build on a LEED. And Chicago and the state of Illinois should be known as the city and the state that is leading as it comes to energy efficiency, and I'm proud that this building is leading the way in that. And this is actually the first cultural institution that I'll be participating in its opening. So I appreciate that. Second, Bruce, we all have worked one way or another with or for Bruce in some event. I started in public life, in politics, first doing the radio show with Bruce and the late Tom Roser. That is how I actually started doing in politics. And I think it's only fitting.
Well, he went on to other things, but we cut him off. So you'll have to tune in. You'll have to watch the website. But again, we appreciate them all for coming.
And he really made a big point of it because it was the first night of the major city mayors meeting in Baltimore, so he stayed here in order to be part of the museum's preview.
And I thought Charles's $500,000 donation was very generous.
Yeah, I thought you were going to match it.
I made it anonymously.
You may see my donations. I thought you guys were going to match it up. I thought you guys were going to match it up tonight.
Bruce, you may see at a number of important cultural institutions the term anonymous.
That's you?
Yeah. I didn't really want to have the attention drawn to myself, but there you have it.
Well, back to our discussion of politics. Again, thanks for everybody that showed up for the big party last week. The one name we did not mention is the guy who is not yet in, and that's John Huntsman. Why would anybody still be thinking about jumping into this race, especially when it's someone who is not a household name? Why would he be doing this?
I actually went to a lunch that Huntsman had in Chicago on Monday, this past Monday, a little private lunch, kind of pitching his wares to some of the hoi polloi here, myself excluded. And he's an impressive guy. I think he does have some comparative advantages on the field, particularly his understanding and experience in China and how that relates to our domestic policy and our economic positioning in the world. So I think that's something that he could exploit. Certainly he has the family money to get off the ground until he can raise money to compete. But, I think he's done some good things as governor of Utah, just as Rick Perry has, just as Tim Pawlenty has. So I think he can kind of hold his own on that platform and maybe make China and his understanding of America's place in the world his comparative advantage. I'm not sure, but I think that's
the play. It's a low-level issue. I wonder if he's running for Secretary of State.
Well, the point is, it seems to me that if Mitt Romney is getting beaten up because the Massachusetts plan was similar to Obamacare, and he's got that albatross around his neck. I mean, when you say all the nice things that Huntsman has said about Obama after being appointed the ambassador of China, it seems to me he's got much more of an albatross around his neck in a Republican primary where you wouldn't expect China policy to be a big deal.
And he's now saying that Obama does not have a foreign policy.
We do have to pause right now. For those listening to us on television, we're going to see you next week. For those listening to us on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour with your phone calls, 1-800-723-8029. The gang will be all back. The big question is, will you be back? We hope so. Back news, back after news around the country. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight with commentary by conservative Dan Proft, liberal Mark Casello, and Charles Ipsen, political science professor from the University of Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. Nice to have you with us this evening. I want to talk one thing we alluded to briefly, very briefly, in hour number one was a number of comments that came out of the Republican debate last week in New Hampshire about the war and about the wars we are in and whether or not we should be bringing some of those troops home. And I want to get a sense from you, Dan, who is our card-carrying conservative Republican tonight. Do you think that is a growing feeling within the Republican Party that maybe it's time to bring the troops home, and this isolationist, at least rhetoric, is something that's growing given the Tea Party as well as others? Certainly, obviously, Ron Paul has been talking about it, you know, for several years now.
Well, yeah, Ron Paul is maybe a little bit in a category by himself, or maybe with Gary Johnson too. But I wouldn't characterize the rhetoric coming from most of the candidates as isolationist the way that John McCain did. I think there is a recognition that America is overstretched in terms of its resources. I think there is a real concern about the clarity of our mission in places like Libya. And real concern about what the alleged Arab Spring is going to bring, and an understanding that with unemployment at 9% and the economy sputtering and stops and starts at least, that the focus of candidates who want to be the Republican nominee or want to be President of the United States needs to, you know, be here at home. So I'm not sure that means that we're walking away from commitments or certainly not keeping an eye on Iraq to make sure that it doesn't fail, figuring out a way to turn over the rest of the effort to stave off the Taliban in Afghanistan to the Afghans. But I think there's just a recognition that there are limitations to America's ability to impose its will.
Mark, where should we put our priorities when it comes to the costs of war? I'm talking about the economic costs of war. At what point does war become too expensive and we cannot pay for it anymore?
Well, I think just first and foremost with these recent wars is that there were no war bonds sold. There was never any intention to pay for this war other than to borrow for it. So I think the average American is hurting and feeling assailed from all directions. And so in the wake of this, I think the average American looking at being in the longest wars in American history now, going on almost 10 years, that the average American's going to say, hey, take care of us at home.
Well, and if I could say one more thing, you know, Walter McDougall, who's an international relations professor at University of Pennsylvania, has a really interesting piece in the latest issue of Humanitas, where he kind of compares this to 1984, where, if you remember, one of the threads in George Orwell's book was about this fictional state of Oceania, and they were constantly at war in far-flung places, and they couldn't remember why they were at war. And I think that, there is a real purpose behind this in terms of prosecuting the war on terror, in terms of keeping the public's attention for the overarching purpose and the return on investment, both in terms of money and the lives of American soldiers, I think it starts to get more and more murky as things drag on without any apparent end.
I agree with comments that both my colleagues have made. I would add a couple of things. One is that the president has not really gone out and made any case for any of the wars publicly. He's not really tried to sell any of this. And the second is that we now see in both Afghanistan and in Pakistan that the people we're working with on the ground are playing these double games. It's a very murky game, and it becomes very difficult to say who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. And what we saw in the first Afghan war, remember, was that the people who were getting the Soviets out of there were turned out to be the people who ultimately were our enemies.
Robert Gates, the outgoing Secretary of Defense, said on television today that really when one is talking about the cost of the war, that you also have to factor in the cost of not doing something, and that the costs of not doing something can be far worse than anything else. And then he alluded to 9/11. Had we not cut defense budgets before that, we wouldn't be paying for a war that's now 10 years old.
He is furious about the $400 billion in cuts that are coming out of the Defense Department, and the fact that the number was kind of plucked out of the air. It didn't seem to be based on any prior analysis of what was actually needed for defense. The Obama administration is proposing really large cuts. My hunch is that as important as these issues are, unless there's a disaster, either in Iraq or a terrorist attack, that foreign policy issues are going to be fairly low on the agenda this year.
Well, but again, if Romney was one that brought it up the other night, if Romney takes a position where using from an economic perspective that we have to cut defense spending and we have to bring troops home, does that give him a place? Once upon a time, that would have been a third rail to touch in a Republican primary. But can he get away with that just because of changing attitudes within the Republican
Party? Well, look, I think it depends on where. I mean, I would cut troops. I could cut
Libya right away.
No, well, not just there. How about Europe? You know, why do we have the troop levels we have in countries that are perfectly capable of providing for their own defense or should be? I think the other thing that's problematic is just the application of whatever the alleged principles or policy is supposed to be in places like the Middle East. Certainly, we are going to intervene in Libya, but we're not intervening in Syria, where many more Syrians have been killed by the Assad regime than Libyans by the Gaddafi regime. So what are the standards that define our engagement? And when it seems like they're hypocritical based on path of least resistance as the only criteria, then it's hard to continue to enjoy popular support for that type of foreign policy.
Mark?
And I'm picking up on Dan's point. I think the administration's walked themselves into a really dangerous political corner regarding the Arab Spring, because they keep – every time they tout the American Spring – the Arab Spring – maybe we'll have an American Spring – but an Arab Spring, it reminds the American people that Egypt's regime fell with not a single American dollar being spent. And so every time they remind it reminds the American people to make that connection between these regimes can change without American investment.
Well, I would say that there is an upside possibility for President Obama, and that is that if Gaddafi is actually removed from power and the new regime turns out to be not sort of thoroughly laced with Islamic elements, then he could say, you know, we sort of pursued a steady low-cost policy here. But I've got to say, their policy in Syria is in shambles. Remember, basically, what Obama's policy has been was to hold out a friendly hand and talk about them as reformers.
Is it fair to say that if Gaddafi is still in power on Election Day next year, That is a ringing indictment of the Obama plan?
Absolutely.
Without question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you agree with that, too?
No, I do. I do agree.
Okay, we all agree on that point. 1-800-723-8289. Your calls when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Happy Father's Day, wherever you're listening tonight. Hope you've been out there on the barbecue, or maybe the wife cooked dinner for you today. From Sugarland, Texas to Vincennes, Indiana, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. And let's go to Jim listening to us in Indiana on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air, Jim.
Hey, good evening, guys. My comment is that think the internal polls must be so bad for Republicans, and I am a Republican, that nobody credible is running right now. These guys are throwing their hat in late for 2016, like I think Clinton did in 1992. I don't think he thought he'd get the nomination then, and I think he saw Bush get, you know, lose 30% of the vote to Buchanan and think, well, maybe I could win, and then Perot, of course, helped him win. I think he was running for 1996, and I think Huntsman, Perry are all running for 2016. That's at least my take. I don't know what your guys think on that.
Why do you think that Mitt Romney is not credible and Tim Pawlenty are not credible?
Well, I think that they're credible, but I think that they're not governing. I mean, right now, they're both retired. They may have good track records. Mm-hmm. But I think that all the other people, like Mitch Daniels, who's actually doing a great job, has a great track record, steps out and says, I'm not going to run. I think there must be something in the polls. And what I think is in the polls, which you see in Chicago, is nobody can win in half these states, like in Illinois and in New York, because there's such a huge lead of nothing but Democratic, you know, congressional districts and huge, huge leads that I think the Republican Party can only win if we get a candidate who introduces what I would call the contract with American cities. And I think somebody's got to come up, a Republican, with 10 things that we'll do to help cities, whether it's education reform, whether it's tenure reform, things that will actually help the lives of people.
Let's let Dan Proft respond because you've touched on a couple of issues that are near and dear to his heart. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, for education reform, it is, but it's mostly a state and local issue. Not that you can't use the bully pulpit of the presidency or a presidential candidate to talk about it, but look, the analogy to the 92 election for Clinton. I mean, yeah, George Herbert Walker Bush had approval ratings at 90% at about this time leading into that cycle. Obama's are under 48. Big difference. There is ample opportunity. It's Obama's poll numbers is what's galvanizing 10 candidates into this race. It's not what's pushing people out. The Mitch Daniels example you give is something peculiar specifically to the Mitch Daniels family, but it has nothing to do with the utter vulnerability of Barack Obama.
Charles,
I appreciate one point that the caller makes, which is that I think that anybody who wants to win the presidency has to have a positive agenda. I don't know if it'll be around cities, but I would say this. I don't think there's any big secret in some internal polling. I think we've seen a lot of public polling. It's hard to beat a president. It's always hard. If he is beaten, it will probably be a reasonably close race. But I think it will come down to Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and I think all are in play.
Well, not only are they in play, I mean, his approval rating in Pennsylvania is 41%. If he loses Pennsylvania, it's game over. He's not going to win North Carolina again. He's not going to win Indiana again. Midwestern states where there were Republican gubernatorial pickups, yep, Wisconsin, right. Michigan, state legislative turnovers, a new Republican governor, New Mexico, another swing state. There's a lot of infrastructure that favors the Republicans.
Well, if he wins, Norm Ornstein. We talked about this last week on this program. Norm Ornstein, he says that because there are Republican governors in those states, and that was the big story. I mean, the pickup of governorships and certainly state legislatures, to me, was the big, big story of the last election we had in this country. But the point is, because those states, the legislatures and the governors, are stuck in deep doo-doo in many cases, they're going to have to make unpopular positions, which may make the Republican Party not as...
That's true, but we have this federal system. And in Illinois, we can see it operating because Illinois has approached this essentially by doing very little. There's a modest pension reform. There's something that they're now talking, serious school reform, but Wisconsin and Indiana have gone in the exact opposite directions. So there's just complete difference of approach, and we will see how it works out. But I've got to tell you, if you're in
which
deep
is the
trouble,
which was
I
the founding North, fathers wanted, didn't they?
They yeah, wanted exactly. Of course they did. I'm in favor
of
this, and I would say that it's true that Republican governors may have to do unpleasant things, but everybody's going to be seeing both Republicans and Democrats around the country responding to these things in different ways. And some people are going to like the cuts. Some people are going to want the tax raise.
Mark,
there's another issue that we haven't brought up yet, which is the shifting demographics of the country. And I think the Obama administration's counting on an increased Hispanic vote and a return of the youth vote. And I think they better not count on that, because I think the young generation who grew up under the Bush administration and saw Abu Ghraib, well, now they've had 4 years of the Obama administration sort of letting them down and disappointing them. And
there's enthusiasm gap.
There's going to be a huge enthusiasm gap.
I mean, look,
do you see that amongst your friends, your liberal friends?
I do, amongst the students I teach. They're coming in, and they're not as they were overjoyed back during the 2008 election season for Obama. It was hard.
It's not cool anymore, right?
It's not as cool. And I don't know how Obama's going to turn that around. He doesn't have a progressive enough agenda to run on for the youth vote.
Well, he's just a mere mortal politician 3 years in, and frankly, he's a mere mortal politician with a bad record. And it's the first time he has to run on a record. And that and look, remember, it may be a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's largely true. Elections are referendums on the incumbent, and it's going to be a referendum on his presidency.
But just remember, he has an outstanding team. Axelrod and Plouffe are excellent. They ran a flawless campaign last time. He has all the advantages of incumbency. He'll have money out the kazoo. So he will be a formidable candidate.
But in this case, the last flawless campaign was a surprise. Mm-hmm. You're saying that he's going to run two flawless campaigns
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying they're experienced and they've got very good people. But I completely agree with Mark's point that the enthusiasm that you not only had with the youth vote, you had $600 an hour lawyers in Chicago who were leaving work to go to Pennsylvania and ring doorbells.
Yeah.
I mean, there was an enthusiasm that was just palpable. You know, you're never going to get that again.
At the end of the day, there's, you know, sometimes there's just not enough expertise and not enough money in the world to sell manure smelling air freshener, and that's what they're running into this time around. It's not enough.
Branding or remarketing, a lukewarm, or controversial healthcare reform, escalated wars, a toothless Wall Street bill that didn't put Glass-Steagall back into place.
Huge amounts of regulation. Right. Huge amounts of regulation.
John Stewart said today when he was being grilled by Chris Wallace that he's disappointed in Barack Obama.
But he was disappointed, it sounds like, for some of the reasons that Mark was saying.
Yes.
He was disappointed because he's not far enough. It's not progressive enough, whereas I think the American public is probably more, at least in the center, disappointed with performance, not whether left or right.
Well, but it's performance that's directly tied to leftist policies. I mean, the reason that liberals are disappointed is because they believe that the oceans were going to recede, because they believe that government can perfect
man. Is
there a way, in your view, Dan Proft, is there a way where John Boehner will come out as a winner in his ongoing discussions and negotiations after the golf game with the president? Is there a way that he can walk the tightrope between what probably is in his heart and then the heavy-breathing Tea Party Republican caucus that he has to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, look, I think
survive it.
I think he can. I think he's done a pretty good job navigating it so far. I think he's been a speaker who has exhibited a good amount of humility, which is something that is refreshing in its novelty.
In a speaker.
In a speaker, right. And so I think he can. Look, the debt ceiling showdown that's looming is going to be very important. Can he extract some spending cuts to show that Republicans are living up to the promise of the 2010 election before they raise the debt ceiling? That will be important. But so far, Boehner has more than held his own with this White House.
You agree?
Can I just say something about the golf game?
Yeah.
I want President Obama to declare a moratorium on golf. It's absolutely the wrong tone. I mean, you've got Boehner and Obama out there putting around. I mean, it just looks terrible when Americans are suffering.
I agree
and,
with that.
You know, I just think, you know, for all the good that Axelrod and his expert team of advisors can do, I just think it's not the tone to be striking right now.
He's really turned you off, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, he's disappointed me, and I supported him. I saw him in person several times during the campaign, but the issues he talked to me about as an audience member during his campaign, he's walked away from.
But I think that, let me push back a little bit. The big problem that he's got is that he put on a big stimulus, and it didn't produce the results. and they are now tapped out. There's just no ability to essentially run on the program that has been the progressive program since FDR. It's really hard for me to understand exactly what the progressive agenda is going to be if you can't pay for it.
Does he get credit for the automobile industry? Does he get any credit at all for General Motors now being the most successful
automobile company
in the world?
He will get political credit.
Absolutely not. No, yeah. I mean it's still a net loser for the American people, and it's going to be. Look, I mean this is somebody who is so much a leaf in the wind now. The progressive agenda is going to be attack the Republicans and talk incessantly about Granny being thrown off a cliff. That's going to be the entire campaign because that's all they got. This is a president who this week was talking about lamenting ATM machines because they take jobs away from bank tellers.
Well, I've got to tell you, there's a perfect response to Granny being thrown off the cliff, which is Granny being strapped to a railroad bed with a train of deficit coming right at you. In other words, you
high
have
speed,
to do
high speed train.
High speed paid for. But you're going to have to do something with this.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. We're taking America's political pulse. How about you? Touch yourself. Do you have a pulse? If you do, give us a call. 1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Happy Father's Day, wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border. Mark Casella is here. He is our liberal this evening. He is a contributor for the Huffington Post. He is also an assistant professor of radical English at Ivy Tech Community College in Bloomington, Indiana. What is radical English? Tell us about radical English for a second or two.
Radical American literature. Basically, I specialize in literature that emanates from Chicago regarding social issues. Literature that was trying to address and change social issues through literature. And it's the way much of our media today does through television and film. But back then it was.
And how did you become interested in such a specific area of the English language and English writing?
My father worked for CTA. He was a union member, worked on putting the Red Line together. And so union issues were important to me. Chicago history is an important part of my life. And so seeing the connections between Richard Wright and earlier authors in Chicago's literary history was interesting to me.
Dan Proff joins us. He is a political commentator for WLS Radio. He's also a talk show host with Bruce Wolf here on the weekends on WLS, and also a candidate for governor in the Republican primary recently. And Charles Lipson joins us. He hails from Marks, Mississippi, and he is a longtime professor for almost 30 years at the University of Chicago, where recently he won the Quantrell Award for Outstanding Undergraduate Teaching. He is author of the book Doing Honest Work in College, which in 50 words or less is about
trying to help students who actually want to do the right thing know what that means, so that the papers that they write are their own, so that the exams that they turn in are completely kosher and all the rest. I'm assuming that students want to do the right thing and learn. I can't help the ones who aren't, but I can help the ones who do know what's right.
Take a moment on Father's Day. Tell us about your father and what role he had in your life.
My late father, I have great admiration for. We grew up, literally, I grew up in my grandfather's backyard in a little house that he had built for my dad, and my great-grandfather was there too, so it was four generations. When I think of my father, I have great memories, and my grandfather and great-grandfather as well. My great-grandfather had been in the Tsar's army, escaped, had amazing tales to tell, but the main thing I want to stress about my father that I wish we saw more of these days is that he was very active in the community. He was in the Masons. He was in the Chamber of Commerce. He was in the Rotary. He was the president of this and the president of that. When the town needed a swimming pool, he helped raise the money for it. And I think that that kind of civil society, civic engagement, is something that we need more of.
And a very small Jewish community in Marks, Mississippi.
Oh, it was the center of Jewish life, really, throughout the country. The three families. In Marx. People look to us. As Marx goes, so goes New York and Philadelphia, was our thinking.
Dan Proft also joins us. Dan, I think you've said on this program before, you were adopted.
Yes. I was. My dad worked for IBM for 35 years. He was an instructor who taught companies how to use the old mainframes that don't exist anymore. And obviously both my mom and my dad adopted me when I was 3 days old. So my parents, I'm fortunate, are still both around. They still live in Wheaton, Illinois, where I grew up. And I just appreciate the sacrifices they made for me to have opportunities that meant that they forewent some of the opportunities that they could have otherwise had.
And Did you ever meet your natural father or have a desire to meet your natural father?
Never have, and never really had any desire. I mean, my take on it is, my parents are the people who raised me and sacrificed for me, and that's pretty much the end of the story.
That's very moving to me because I adopted my twin boys when they were 3 days old at the hospital. I have one of the proudest pictures I have is of my wife and me carrying the babies out of the hospital. Michael and Jonathan are 26 years old now. They're close to us. They're close to each other. They're close to Mom. So it's a happy Father's Day for us.
And speaking of fathers, I would like to just take a moment that when I think about what I have done with my life, it was on my 10th birthday, June 18th of 1954, my father took me to a television studio, which was owned by my Uncle Alan B. Dumont in New York on my 10th birthday. I fell in love with television. I met Captain Video. I sat in the spaceship. You know what that means?
Yes,
since we
absolutely.
Are of a similar generation, Charles. And also,
I didn't sit in the spaceship.
No, it was. I've known what I've wanted to do since I was 10 years old because of that experience. And the other one was my father would drive me to school in grammar school. And before we got out of the car every single day, we would listen to Paul Harvey on the radio. And then we would talk about what Paul Harvey said on the radio, and we would continue that conversation over dinner at night. And so my bonding experience with my father was not at a ball game, was not playing catch. It was in the front seat of a 1948 Plymouth listening to Paul Harvey on the radio. And now I have the honor of being on the same flagship station that Paul Harvey is on, WLS Radio.
And you got to know Paul and Angel very well.
And had the opportunity to sit in for him, which was one of the scariest experiences of my professional life.
Good day.
Let's go to Sally, listening to us on WLS Radio. We digress a little bit to talk about our fathers on Father's Day. But, Sally, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Bruce, and happy Father's Day to all of you.
Thank you.
I don't know. I was just listening, and I heard one of your commentators say that Americans are suffering. And my question is, how does he define suffering? Because now I live in Chicago, and I've been doing a little traveling. I've been to New Orleans. I've been to Atlanta. I don't see all this suffering. I see new cars. I tried to get in a restaurant Friday. The line was out the door. I rode past Rush Street. People were all lined up at the restaurants. People are in the shops buying, packed. You know, where is this suffering? Now, if he wants to say struggling, sure, I can go along with struggling, but we always seem to adjust to the so-called bad times. You know, we cut this out, we cut that out, cable. You know, you don't drive your car, you take your transit. So I just, you know, I resent him using the word suffering, you know, saying that the president in the golf trip, to my understanding, or the golf play that they did, my understanding was that they were supposed to be trying to negotiate on this debt limit or the budget.
Let's let Mark respond. I think he was the one that used that term.
Okay, what's his name?
Mark Casello.
Okay.
Great. No, thank you, caller, and I appreciate the point. And so you're stressing the distinction between suffering and struggling. And I think struggling is the point where many Americans are. They've cut back. They've gotten they're doing with less than they were. Their gas prices are up. There's nothing wrong with that, but the people I see on a daily basis, I work for a community college where there's displaced workers. Thousands upon thousands of people have lost their jobs. Jobs have moved overseas. They're trying to feed families, and it's beyond doing with less. We're talking about people whose government, their assistance has been cut off. They're trying to retrain themselves for new careers because their jobs are never coming back, and those people are truly suffering. And I lived in Gary, Indiana, and that's where I went to college. In Gary, Indiana, and Detroit, those people are suffering.
Is when you talk about suffering, and this lady's making, I think, an important point. struggle. Everyone at some point in their life is going to go through struggle. Sometimes struggles last an entire lifetime. But what is it that government can do to ease struggle? Because struggle is a basic element of life. I mean, they can't control it all.
Sure.
And, what can they do? What should they do?
So that's the foundational debate of our political season this year. But I think one thing I often say is that people will help themselves if they have the means to. But many of the people I encounter are so pushed beyond the limits of where they can even recover from.
Is that because the politicians, be they Republicans, Democrats, liberal or conservatives, they don't have the cojones to tell the people what the truth is, the truth, the whole truth, that some of these jobs are not coming back, so you hold out this possibility, this hope that, you know, a job is going to come back, when in reality they know it's not going to come back?
It was one of the great scenes in the Bill Clinton movie, what was the name of that, Primary Colors, where he tells the people in New Hampshire that their jobs are not coming back, but that he'll help them retrain. I want to agree with a couple of points that the caller made. The first is that I see what she sees, which is, and I'm sure we all do, which is you walk down North Michigan Avenue, the fanciest shopping street, but this would be true on Madison Avenue in New York or Rodeo Drive, and you see lots of prosperity and you see lines for the top restaurants. By the same token, we know that unemployment is at a very high level, over 9%, and then, or around 9%, and that the number of people who've given up hunting for jobs makes the misery index really high.
Well, if you give up for a job, how do you survive? When you give up, what do you do?
When you give up, it may mean that your husband, your wife, or you're on unemployment or something else.
Or you don't go on a vacation.
But there's a second. That's right. You're living off of savings, if you have any. But the second point is, and I think this is where the big debate is where's the path to growth? And I think that you will see fundamentally different answers. And I think that the problem that President Obama will have in running for reelection is that his path to growth has palpably failed.
Yeah, and here's a point that I'm sure Dan will take the other side on. But one point I just want to remind the American people of is that corporations have no rights other than those conferred by law upon them. So here in America, if we complain about jobs moving overseas or profits being exported constantly, those are rights that our legislators have given to these corporations. If CEOs are making 500 times what the worker makes, that's a law we've written, and those laws can be changed to improve the lives of everyday Americans.
Dan Prof will have the other side of that story and the other side of this commercial break. 1-800-723-8029. Taking America's political pulse from coast to coast, heading into our 31st year on Father's Day 2011. Coming to you live from the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street in Chicago. From Youngstown, Ohio to Sykeston, Missouri, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to Larry listening to us on our flagship station, WLS from Roberts, Illinois. Go ahead.
Bruce, I'll make this part real quick. Congratulations on your birthday yesterday.
Thank you very much. It's nice to have birthdays.
You share a birthday with my youngest son, who was 31 yesterday.
Well, mazel tov, and also I share it with Paul McCartney and Roger Ebert and Andy Shaw, who is a political commentator in Chicago.
All great minds. You know, talking about the election of 2012, which is a ways off, I'm afraid that Obama will probably win no matter what happens. Sally pretty much summed it up. We look at the bright lights and the glitter. We don't see the guy whose mortgage is upside down. We don't see that we're, you know, having a lot of these problems, because those are in areas where people just don't look. You know, once in a while CBS News does this and they'll show this or that, but usually they focus in on the glitz and the glamour, and so we don't really see what's going on. And it took Ronald Reagan to say, you know, it's the silent majority. The silent majority is still quiet, and the Republicans are lining up in a circle so they can get in a firing squad.
Dan Prof.
Well, yeah, I agree with you in terms of where the media focuses, but the silent majority, those people whose houses are upside down, they know that.
Yes.
And so for in the city of Chicago, for example, 56% of homeowners are upside down on their mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think that those people know the precarious financial situation that they are in, and that will not drive or inform the votes, the choice they make at the polls? Of course it will. So just because the media doesn't pay attention or the media doesn't frame things with the proper context or provide information that is at all consequential doesn't mean that those individual people that are struggling, that right. have seen their fortunes markedly change under this president, will not make their voices heard when they go to vote.
Yeah, and my point is that is there's a lot of people that are going to be voting that don't even care. They just say, oh, we can't have a Republican in there again. When our last election, Obama ran against Bush, and Bush wasn't even running. So who does McCain run against? McCain ran against Bush.
Yeah, but Obama doesn't have that luxury this time.
No, he doesn't.
No, it's going to be a referendum on him. Before the break, Mark was making a comment. He took a broadside at corporate America, and I know you wanted to respond, Dan.
Well, I mean, it's just Mark's position is just the typical kind of leftist position of economics is a zero-sum game. That if somebody is making $250,000 or $250 million, for that matter, that means somebody else can't. And it's just simply not the case. I mean, this gets back to what Obama talks about and all the time of the people making $250,000 a year, they need to contribute more. Well, you could confiscate the wealth of everybody making $250,000 or more, and you'd finance government operations in this country for 90 days because it's a spending problem, not a revenue problem. I think the opportunity that Republicans have, and Tim Pawlenty is the one who sees this most in a most detailed fashion to this point, is to present that growth agenda that Charles was talking about. And Tim Pawlenty put a marker down with his 5% growth plan, which talks about flattening and lowering income tax rates and eliminating taxes on things we want to see more of, like investment, so eliminating the capital gains tax.
Do you think that's realistic?
I think it. I'm not sure about elimination, but certainly flattening and scaling down.
But the 5% growth.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. Okay. This is about policy choices.
It's doable.
Look, everybody wants to bemoan America, and essentially, especially on the left, say we need to get hep to our new position as a second rate power in the world. That is not a foregone conclusion. America is still the number one manufacturing in the world. America still produces 25% of all GDP in the world. We do not have to subsume ourselves to China or anybody else if we make policy choices that reward work and investment.
Gary is listening to us in northern Indiana.
Good evening, Bruce.
Are you Gary from Gary, or are you from someplace else in northern Indiana?
I'm just passing through on I-94.
Very good.
The reason I'm calling is just wanted to touch base on the Federalist argument that Romney's making, also Rick Perry.
Yep.
And Mark Levin made this comment that, big government is big government, whether it's at the state level or at the federal level. And what Romney did in Massachusetts, even though he has a right to do that inside that state, is big government, big bureaucracy. And, that's really the argument that I have against his moving into the White House.
Charles,
commentary on that.
Charles,
I think that's a very intelligent point. And all I would say is that you have options when your state has policies that you don't when your federal government has policies. During the growth miracle in Massachusetts under Dukakis that he ran on when he was running for president, there was no net immigration into that state, whereas Texas, Florida, these are states with low taxes and so forth, and they've really been growing.
Gene in Chicago, go ahead. You're on the air, coast to coast.
Hi, wonderful show.
Thank you.
I've stated my preference for Mitt Romney as president before, and I also want to say, whatever happened to Rudy Giuliani, the powerhouse of a man? And, I mean, is he backing out or something? Because, what he's done in New York is phenomenal. He'd make a wonderful president.
Well, he had his opportunity a couple of years ago, and if his road to the White House had been more well thought out, maybe he would have gone a little bit further. But some people look better on the sidelines, and I think, I was a big supporter of Rudy Giuliani 4 years ago, and I agree with you. I think he would make a great president, but I don't think he makes a great candidate.
Bruce, you mentioned that you listened to Chris Wallace today, right?
Yes, I thought he absolutely excoriated John Stewart.
You know what? I couldn't get him on my TV set. Why? I could not get him on. There was another thing on 32 at 11 a.m. It was an Hispanic show.
He's not on 11 o'clock. He's on from 9 to 10, in the Chicago market. And by the way, go to Fox News, look at Fox News Sunday, watch the interview with Chris Wallace and Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart is on his heels. If there was a referee would have stopped that interview because Chris Wallace was beating the you-know-what out of Jon Stewart. On that note, Mark Casella, we thank you very much. And Dan Propp, we thank you very much. Yes. Charles Lipson, we thank you as well. This program is a Jenny B. production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman and Mark Glick for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago. Yeah.